This is Radio MD COVID-19 weekly, but still your source for COVID-19 news from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Caitlin White, and that's right, this is the first of our now weekly Wednesday episodes. Later in this show, we hear from the experts on how to help kids understand social distancing and some tips on coping with extra pandemic stress. And our healthcare hero is the medical director of primary care physicians at Marin Health. She tells us more about their mobile COVID-19 unit. But now our news update. Testing for the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine as a possible treatment for coronavirus has been halted because of safety fears. That's according to the World Health Organization. The BBC reports that decision comes after a recent medical study suggesting that the drug could actually increase the risk of patients dying from COVID-19. The study found that the patients were more likely to die in a hospital and develop heart rhythm complications than other COVID patients in a comparison group. The mix of summer heat and being absolutely stir-crazy at this point is bringing people out of their homes, regardless of what stage of the pandemic we're in. This article has been sent to me a number of times as I navigate summer plans with my friends. NPR reporters sat down with a number of experts to talk about some of our favorite hot weather activities and rate them on a scale of risk of contracting coronavirus. For example, a backyard gathering with one other household, low to medium risk. Eating indoors at a restaurant, medium to high risk. Spending the day at a popular beach or pool, low risk. We've been told to stay inside for months now, but being outside and in the world is also important to the health of the human being. So what happens to your immune system when you're inside all of the time? Radio MD's Bill Klaproth.
While staying inside our homes is helping to shield us from the pandemic, missing out on time outdoors might alter our risk of catching diseases in other ways. Okay, why is that? Well, the sun helps in the production of vitamin D in the skin in response to UVB exposure. This daily dose of vitamin D can help to strengthen our bones and teeth, but it also has an effect on our immune cells. Vitamin D is a first line of defense against respiratory infections, killing bacteria and viruses directly. And as you know, COVID-19 attacks the lungs. Researchers are now investigating whether vitamin D supplements reduce the risk of some of the severe complications associated with COVID-19. In the meantime, though, there is a strong argument for getting a dose of vitamin D by spending more time outdoors. For Radio MD News, I'm Bill Klaproth.
And a new development, the novel coronavirus does not spread easily on surfaces or objects. That's according to a CDC update last week. They say that they are still learning about how the virus spreads and the severity of illnesses it causes, but have now said that COVID-19 is thought to spread mainly from person to person. Still, you should be washing your hands. We all need a certain level of good stress to enjoy life. It's a level of stress in which we can handle. But ongoing stress releases a stress hormone called cortisol, which plummets our immunity. That is never a good thing, but is especially bad at this point in human history during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Michael S. Evangel joined Dr. Suzanne Bennett on her Radio MD podcast, Wellness for Life, to discuss 10 ways to override our genetic hardwiring to respond to stress in a healthier way.
Let's dive in here. What is the difference between eustress and what most of us feel right now, which is stress in general?
A great question. First thing, that we're all under stress our entire lives. The first stress is the stress of birth. And from there on, we have all types of stressors that we experience. Physical stress, emotional stress, chemical stresses on the body. But when we talk about stress in general, we're talking about something that is not acceptable or not good, something that we don't like. But all stress isn't bad. And the situation of eustress is actually the ideal level of stress. It's like the Goldilocks zone. It's not too much, not too little, just right. And basically, eustress is the stress we can handle, and we have pretty much complete cycles of action. So we have a stress that presents itself. It might be a problem, it might be a task, and we complete it, and we finish it, almost like a painter, a Rembrandt, looking at a masterpiece, and then a sigh of relief, it's over, it's done. So that's nice, but now we have a lot of incomplete cycles of action, things that we're experiencing now. And basically, the stress situation we have is a hormonal as well as neurological response to it. And when we talk about, like I said, stress, it's not the eustress. It's not like good things, things that we're happy with. Because if you just put yourself in an isolation chamber with no sensory perception at all, that would be a huge stress to us. And people actually start to hallucinate when they're in that situation because the body craves some type of stimulation. But during primitive times, we were placed under a stress and we either survived or we did not. And that is what's involved with the adrenal response. And Seeley was the one that came up with the whole fight or flight concept. But there's another one in there, freeze, the three Fs, fight, flight, and freeze. And unfortunately today, when we're under something that's not a pleasant stress, over 99.99% of those stressors, we cannot run away, we cannot fight and kill somebody, and we can't freeze and do nothing. We have to deal with the situation. And that is the problem now because we're really in uncharted waters. We've never had a situation like this before in the, you know, entire human history of civilization. We've never had a situation like the old science fiction movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And that's really what's happening now. We're in a state of really freeze around the globe where everybody is in a shutdown. So what I suggest to do then is to deal with it because we can't escape it and we can't freeze and do nothing. We can't really fight and beat somebody up. And what happens is that when you have that adrenal response, we go through hormonal and neurological reaction. Like I was saying, adrenaline is released. Your heart starts pounding. You start breathing heavier. Your blood starts pumping faster through your veins. And you're ready for action. But unfortunately, there is no action to take right now like that. And what ends up happening is that cortisol is released, another stress hormone. And unfortunately, cortisol does one very bad thing pertaining to the situation of today. It drops our immunity. It crashes our immunity. So how to deal with that, how to fight against that, it's a dilemma because it's almost like Alfred Hitchcock used to have with his horror movies. And he was a master at that. That was way before all of the FX, all of these special effects. And he used to have a shadow, something off to the distance, a noise, something that in your imagination you would conjure up a boogeyman much worse than you could see actually on the screen. Because our imagination is a good as well as a bad thing.
You can hear this interview in full on Dr. Suzanne Bennett's Radio MD podcast, Wellness for Life, found on any podcast platform. And by this time in the COVID-19 pandemic, your kids might be going a little stir crazy. Social distancing was designed to reduce the risk of the virus to thrive. But your kids, especially the little ones, probably don't understand why they can't have a play date or go to the playground. Older kids are also trying to find ways to sneak out of the house to meet up with their friends. Jennifer Verist joined Radio MD's Melanie Cole on our other podcast, Healthy Children, to help parents teach their kids about why social distancing is so important.
First of all, playgrounds. I mean, because it can live on the surfaces of the playground equipment. Is that why? Or because you would be too close to another child? Because some kids want to go out and sit at the playground like 6 feet from each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a couple of reasons. So, as we all know, the New England Journal of Medicine released a study that has been propagated through multiple media outlets on how long the virus can survive on different surfaces. Now, with plastic, we're seeing that it can survive like 2 to 3 days, maybe longer. With stainless steel, it can survive quite a long time. And so that is one reason. We don't know who has touched those surfaces prior to your child sitting on it and touching it. The other thing is that when we know how difficult it is, just think about it. For moms who have younger kids at home, how difficult it is to manage them, tell them not to touch things, remind them to wash their hands, remind them to cover their mouth when they cough or sneeze. When we go on playgrounds or on play dates, we know how hands-on kids can be, and we have less of that control that we have in the home and less of that like direct supervision that we have in the home. So that increases the likelihood of them getting closer than the 6 feet and, you know, coming into contact with each other in a way that would not be conducive to reducing the spread of the virus. But there are alternatives. So for, let's see, like for older children who can comply with maintaining the 6 feet, it's okay to take a walk in the park. It's okay to take a nature walk where you're not coming in, you're not touching any surfaces, and you're not getting closer than 6 feet within anybody else. And for other children who, you know, would like to talk to their friends, there is always the option of virtual meetings. That doesn't have to go away. And there are lots of activities that we can do with our children at home to keep them busy.
Well, that certainly is good advice. And I mean, I've even heard my kids who are older teenagers say, well, if my friend's been isolating for 14 days and hasn't gone anywhere or done anything, why can't they come over? And I've been trying to explain to them, well, you don't know really who's coming and going from their house or what's been touched or if they've had groceries. We don't know. And so exactly. That's another discussion, right, is even if their friends are isolating, they still can't get together because there's just this unknown.
Exactly. And there's too much risk with that. We are seeing and we now know that someone can carry the coronavirus and not have any symptoms at all. And so really it is prudent to behave like everybody outside the home could be a possible carrier. That's really the mindset that we need to approach this with. And yeah, so that is the concern. Even if, you know, the person seems fine, so they're not having any symptoms, we at this point, we do not know that they are not a carrier.
So what are some alternatives to play dates? You mentioned for teenagers, obviously, they can FaceTime. They sit there and Snapchat or make TikToks for each other. They don't really care. But the younger ones, I mean, I really don't think they care. My kids absolutely do not care. But I mean, the younger ones and even the tweens that are sort of like itching to get with their friends, what do we do with them?
Awesome. So that's a great question. For the younger ones, this is a great time to spend time with them. The American Academy of Pediatrics has always recommended reading with your child. So for younger children, this increases their speech development. They can look at your mouth, see how you move your lips when you make the words. And so it's a great time to bond, and it increases their speech development. So reading a book with your child is great. There are a lot of activities that children can play with on their own while mom gets some things done in the house. They can play with balls, blocks, jump ropes. I've been seeing some awesome masterpieces of the faux stained glass art where, you know, you use the tape to make the designs. I think that's on fences, on bedroom windows. That's a great activity to keep your child busy. We also want to help the child have a sense of normalcy by developing new routines, because as the, you know, time of shutdown has been extended, I think more and more parents are realizing, you know, there's a possibility my child is likely not going back to school this semester. So rather than wasting precious time just like watching movies and videos and waiting it out, it's a great time to return a new schedule to the family. So for older children, you know, we still recommend the 9 to 10 hours of sleep. So creating a routine that returns that to their lives. Also having a family meeting where we talk about, okay, what are some of the goals with this? We know that things are not like what they used to be, but they don't have to be completely, you know, disorganized. We can have a new routine that's set up. So what are some things that are really important to you? So for example, education goals with online learning or fitness goals or health goals. How are we going to stay active? Emotional goals. How are we going to maintain a positive outlook throughout all of this? And then together as a family, creating a schedule that's realistic for everyone and meets those goals and needs. Virtual meetings are great. But we don't want to allow our teens to spend, you know, all of their time online or looking at a screen. We still want to keep an eye on screen time. And for the younger children, parents still want to be that gatekeeper. We want to, there's a lot of negative information out there. And as a parent, you want to be the one to set the tone for your family and for your household. You kind of want to be the gatekeeper and the fact checker for your child. And so that's another way to kind of keep an eye on what your child is watching.
You can hear this full conversation on another of our Radio MD podcasts, Healthy Children, also found on any podcast platform. We go now to our healthcare hero today, Elizabeth Lowe. She is the Medical Director of Primary Care Physicians at Marin Health, and she tells us a bit more about her COVID-19 mobile unit. Elizabeth, tell us about how it has been working on the front lines of a disease like this. How do you and your staff just keep going day after day?
It's been an incredible opportunity to work with a bunch of extremely dedicated staff from the RNs and the nurse practitioners and the medical assistants, as well as all of the people I have met through the Department of Public Health and all the incredible colleagues at Kaiser. The work ethic has just been higher than I've ever seen it or remember it since residency. People are selfless. They are willing to step up and help out wherever needed. And it's just been incredibly empowering and invigorating. I hadn't felt this satisfied at doing this work in a long time. And that has really been restorative for me. In the past, I've said this to a number of people. I used to go and do medical mission work in Guatemala. I've been in Central America. I've been in the British West Indies. And I had to travel outside of this country to get that same feeling that you're doing good along with other people. And this is the first time I've had that feeling here in my own country, my own county, my town. This feeling that we are all in this together, working for a greater goal for our community. And that has been very, very motivating. The atmosphere in the, when we unload our stuff at a testing site, when we greet our colleagues who arrived at the same time, everyone's usually in a good mood, which is unusual. There's just a good energy. I don't know how else to describe it other than just a really good energy in a sense that people are working together, which I think humans are at their best when they have that feeling, and it's not a competition. Rather, it's a collaboration. I think people feed off of that positive energy, and I know I do. So, and I see it in other people. It manifests as the willingness to do any job at hand without complaint. So that's been fantastic to experience.
Do you have any stories you could think of community members helping the hospital or staff going above and beyond to help patients?
I actually posted a request on Nextdoor, the neighborhood chat group, I was notifying them that I was going out into nursing homes and residential care facilities as well as homeless shelters. And there had already been a movement to make masks, cloth masks, for people within the community. And I asked if people would be willing to donate some masks for my van so that I could then hand them out to any of these facilities where I saw that people might not be adhering to the mask rule. And I received an overwhelming response. I actually used recycled scrubs from our clinic that had were sizes that no one was wearing, and I donated the fabric to my neighbors, and they returned hand-sewn masks to me, all kinds of styles and fashions, and I've been able to, lots of times it's been a portal of entry to some of these smaller facilities who might otherwise think that we were coming to cite them or to judge them, whereas it was completely opposite. We've been trying to help them and make sure that they feel supported. So handing those hand-sewn cloth masks from the neighborhood have really been an icebreaker and a way to get in to make sure that they are feeling helped and supported. That's one instance I could think of. And then I had another personal instance myself where one of my patients was diagnosed in a small care home. And I was unable to get hospice on site in a quickly enough manner to be able to provide care on site. And he was growing, and his wishes were to not be transferred to the hospital. He was 91, and he didn't want to be transferred to a hospital. And he might have lost contact with his family if that had happened. So I got on the phone and arranged for the local oxygen company to deliver a tank of oxygen. And I called the hospice center and asked them for the orders that they normally write for pain medications for their patients for comfort care. And I wrote the orders and had the pharmacy deliver them. And I left a full PPE unisuit and some PPE equipment for his daughter, who could then come on site and be with him and hold his hand and be with him, which was an experience that would not have been possible had he been transferred to the hospital. And that really touched me, because it was really an opportunity to provide hands-on care to my patients out in the community. And usually this is several steps removed from me now, where I'm just signing orders in my office and someone else is delivering the care. And that was a really nice personal time for me to make me feel like I was part of something bigger than myself, and maybe a part of changing the way we practice medicine going forward from this.
What have been some of your takeaways during this pandemic? I mean, what have you guys learned?
Some of the takeaways I've learned have been, I think originally we were screening for travel and fever and symptoms, and that still exists, but we have certainly broadened our screening, especially in elderly patients and those with dementia, because a lot of these residential care facilities are caring for either disabled adults or patients with dementia, neurologic impairments, or other cognitive impairments. You can't rely on the classic screening or the idea that they might express their symptoms to you. Rather, you have to look for a change in behavior or a change in cognition. And for that, we really rely heavily on the facility and the staff, who know their patients and their clients well, to be able to alert us to the possibility that a patient could be infected. I think that's one of them. It's amazing how our testing criteria has changed over time. And the fact, as I said before, we've been screening asymptomatic workers with the idea that they are likely the carriers. So that also has changed. You have to be, I call it every day is a new day at the improv, because every day it's something new. We're constantly changing how we do things, how we're testing, how we send the labs. And that, again, we rely heavily on our collaborative approach, where we can share information back and forth between healthcare organizations. So I think mostly it's a willingness to be open to suggestions and the latest information, which keeps things never dull, never boring.
Tell us a bit more about the mobile unit itself and how the work there has changed during this pandemic.
We never had a mobile unit prior to this pandemic beginning. It basically arose in late March, when we noticed that patients were being transferred from what we call the lower level residential care facilities, where they don't have a nurse or an LVN on site. And patients, the usual prior pathway had been, if a patient appeared to be unstable, they would be transferred to the emergency department to be assessed and either admitted or transferred back to their facility. That was the easiest way to make this happen. And once we noticed that happening one time, and a patient who'd been transferred back had tested positive for COVID in those earlier days, the results would take longer than one day. So when the patient was transferred back to the facility and a positive test would come out, suddenly the facility became exposed, as did the emergency room. So we developed the idea of going to the facility itself to assess the patient. I originally went there with a portable, rollable toolbox that was outfitted with a stethoscope and a pulse oximeter, as well as some testing swabs. And I just went on site and assessed the patients to determine whether or not they should be screened for COVID-19. And then I would test them there at the facility. And it turns out quite a number of them had the infection. I then repurposed a van that we had been using for shuttling employees back and forth, and they weren't having to do that because of the shelter in place. I repurposed the van and started using that to go from facility to facility. At the same time, I recognized that there were other non-Marin Health Medical Network patients, mostly Kaiser patients, and they had a team who was also starting to do this. And we recognized that the facility became the, we used to call the patients, the PUIs, the patient under investigation. We recognized you couldn't just sort out one patient at a time in a large residential care facility where patients sometimes share common living areas and certainly common dining areas. We had to look at the facility as a whole, look at the structure and the configuration and the rooms, as well as the staff, to determine the susceptibility or vulnerability to infection. So we began starting a daily morning huddle phone call, which we now continue to do every day, where we talk amongst ourselves about outbreaks that we have heard either through Kaiser or the Department of Public Health or our hospital. And we develop a collaborative approach to the management of this problem. And now when we go out as a collaborative unit from all practitioners in the county. It's really been an unusual, an unprecedented collaboration. Usually in the past, we'd been seen as competitors with each other, and now we have decided that the competition is the virus, and the rest of us are all on the same team fighting this together. So it's been an incredible opportunity to work in partnership with healthcare programs across the county. And that never existed before this. The other part of our mobile unit testing is that initially we thought the residents were the sources of the infection. And through our testing, we have recognized that it has been the asymptomatic workers who may work in one or two or three different facilities and have been going to and from their homes. They have been the ones who've been the carrier of the infection, who likely have transmitted it to their patients unknowingly. They have come in and tried to follow every possible safety precaution. But it's hard when you're trying to screen workers for symptoms when they are asymptomatic carriers and likely to be, as we say, pre-symptomatic. If they will develop symptoms, they are likely infectious or contagious prior to their developing symptoms. So that is a really hard one to try to catch in advance of transmission.
Hear more about Marin Health as well as their own show, The Healing Podcast, at mymarinhealth.org. And this has been Now Radio MD's COVID-19 Weekly. Let us know how you like our once-a-week schedule, or if you don't like it, at COVID19daily@radiomd.com. Yeah, for right now, the email is still COVID19daily@radiomd.com. I hope you're enjoying these last days of May. I'm Caitlin White. Stay home and stay healthy.